supporting WHYY Penn Medicine, helping to find new cures for cancer. With life-saving clinical trials and advanced surgical techniques, Penn Medicine is offering more hope for patients everywhere. Learn more at PennMedicine.org/cancer. Penn Medicine, what's next?
Philadelphia is exploring the controversial idea of opening a so-called safe injection site, a place where drug users can shoot up under medical supervision. I'm Dave Heller, and this is NewsWorks Tonight. While the mayor's office deliberates, some city council members are saying safe injection sites already have their support. For WHYY's Behavioral Health Desk, Joel Wolfram reports.
Councilwoman Helen Gim says the sites are an important public health solution to addiction.
Safe injection sites in particular are one of the more promising approaches that many cities have used around the world to help deal with the epidemic that we're seeing and the scourge of addiction that's tearing families apart.
Advocates say safe injection sites help prevent overdose deaths and help nudge drug users into treatment, housing programs, and other services that ease the harm caused by addiction. The Philadelphia Inquirer reported Gim's support for the sites earlier this week. Now Councilman Mark Squilla says he supports opening a safe injection site under certain conditions.
If it's going to be a site where it's going to be monitored by the city of Philadelphia, be able to get them into rehabs and talk to them and give them the social services necessary, then I would support it.
City officials are planning to visit this kind of site in Vancouver as it weighs whether to bring one here. But other city council members warn it could be tough to find a neighborhood that'll welcome the idea and wonder if the city could be getting into legal hot water by sanctioning drug use. But Gim is optimistic that the city can work through these challenges.
This is a discussion that I think the city is ready and willing to engage in. I think that my hope will be that there will be a decision before the end of the year.
For WHYY, Joel Wolfram.
Let the buyer beware is sound advice for retail customers. It's also a consideration for the many cities, including Philadelphia, vying to entice Amazon to build HQ2, a proposed second North American headquarters. Joining me in discussion is Philadelphia Business Journal Editor-in-Chief Craig I. Craig, welcome back to NewsWorks Tonight.
Hi, Dave. Thank you.
We'll get to HQ2, but let's note the extent to which Amazon is already a player in Philadelphia, surrounding suburbs, New Jersey, and Delaware.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, Amazon is very much a player, really across the region. And what's really interesting, as part of HQ2, we talk a lot about incentives that are going to be needed to lure the company. But they're already getting a ton of incentives in these states.
In what form?
It's in tax breaks. We see it in New Jersey under the Grow New Jersey program with $39.4 million in tax breaks. We see it in Pennsylvania, where Governor Wolf agreed to give Amazon $22.5 million in tax breaks.
Amazon is certainly not unique in this regard.
Absolutely. You know, what's interesting about Amazon, though, is the fact that it comes in and it does have a disruptive effect on the businesses on Main Street, on the retailers. And that's really where the controversy comes in.
Is that damage already done?
I think it probably is. But I think the question is, should we be subsidizing that kind of thing?
Among the counterarguments, though, HQ2 is thought to bring in some 50,000 jobs and with that, tax revenue.
Right. And make no mistake, I mean, Amazon has already brought in a ton of jobs. I mean, they already employ almost 9,000 people in Pennsylvania alone. So, you know, that's the question. We need jobs in Pennsylvania. We need jobs in New Jersey. We need jobs in Delaware.
Is it a matter of politicians who operate on the short-term reelection cycle merely thinking, well, any job is better than no job?
Yeah, I think that's partially true. And that is one of the criticisms that you hear of the Amazon jobs, is they are low-paying kind of jobs in the warehouse, in the distribution center.
And so what are some of the criteria where, if it was your call, municipalities would assess whether it's truly a value to entice Amazon?
That's a tough question because, you know, as I said, we do need jobs. But you really have to weigh that against our disruption of the local companies and businesses who are selling online, selling on Main Street, selling in bricks and mortar. Another point is there's highways and rail lines. Would they come here even without incentives?
At what price point does a municipality make that decision?
That's exactly right. And that is the calculation that has to be made on all of these kinds of things. Now, I will say, if you look around the country, in some places, what Amazon had promised didn't come true. If you look in Texas and California and Massachusetts and some other places, it hasn't come true. However, all the incentives that we've given so far in the local area have turned into jobs. So Amazon, you know, as far as all the audits in Pennsylvania, is indeed fulfilling its promise.
Though in real time, I understand this month presents a deadline for applicants, including perhaps Philadelphia, to submit their bids.
October 19th is the deadline.
So do you have legitimate concerns whether that due diligence has been performed?
Well, to be honest, Dave, I worry in Philadelphia there are some competing bids around the region. So if you look at Baltimore, for example, you know, what you see is a state, a city, and a county that's all on the same page. We're not necessarily seeing that really in Philadelphia. What we're seeing is we're hearing about a city bid, we're hearing about a Camden bid, we're hearing about a bid in Atlantic County, in Wilmington as well.
You know, once upon a time, the encroachment, as some termed it, of Walmart was going to bring about the demise of Main Street, and to varying degrees that may be the case. Interestingly, Walmart is now setting itself up as Amazon's main competitor. The point being, retail will continue to evolve and change.
Absolutely.
And I just want to make clear that you're not holding Amazon accountable.
No, there's no question about that. You know, it's a question of really of the degree of incentives that Amazon gets. And that should be a discussion.
And again, you know the cost coming in, the cost to entice Amazon, but it's much more difficult, I presume, to project the benefit that the city and region will accrue in the long run.
It is, it is. And you know, and there's another thing, too. I mean, we hear a lot about robotics and what's going to be happening, you know, in distribution and warehousing and robotics. So will those jobs that are promised actually come to be?
Oh, I hope you were going to answer that question.
We just don't know.
Craig, thanks so much for joining us on NewsWorks tonight.
Thank you, Dave. My pleasure.
Philadelphia Business Journal Editor-in-Chief Craig Eye. Though Amazon's distribution centers have mixed results regarding payback on tax incentives and subsidies, that hasn't stopped several cities from vying to be the site of the company's second headquarters. But along with jobs and tax revenue, the city of Seattle, home to the online retail giant's first headquarters, has also ended up with diversity issues. It's a problem endemic to the tech industry, and one that Amazon has been wrestling with. From NPR member station KUOW in Seattle, Joshua McNichols reports.
It's lunchtime in Seattle's South Lake Union neighborhood. Employees pour out of Amazon's headquarters. Ruchika Tolshian and I sit on a bench. Tolshian is a Seattle author and a journalist who covers diversity in the tech industry.
Who do you see walking in and out of this building?
Currently, I've seen a group of about, I'd say, six, all men. Almost everyone in the group is white and probably around the age of 30. So 30s, male, white.
In Seattle, we call those guys tech bros. As we sit, we do see some diversity. Young men of apparent Chinese or Indian ancestry. They're dressed like programmers, in hoodies and jeans.
I see an African-American man wiping down the surfaces around the Amazon building.
Tolshian says Amazon brings a lot of wealth and opportunity to Seattle, but it's not equally shared. She says, just look at Amazon's top executives. They're all white and mostly men.
We see a lot of people of color at Amazon as support employees, warehouse employees, but certainly when it comes to decision-making capability, certainly when it comes to those big fat stock options and those big salaries, you know, it goes to white employees.
The whiteness of the tech industry has helped make Seattle 2% more white since 2010. You can see the change happening. Seattle's neighborhood of Beacon Hill has long had a strong Asian American community. Austin Monique Sebelbia grew up there.
Our neighbors were more than just people we lived next to. They were almost close to family. Like, I would call some of my neighbors auntie and uncle, even if we weren't related.
But Sebelbia doesn't work in tech. She works in restaurants. When it came time for her to get a place of her own, she couldn't afford Beacon Hill. The neighborhood had been discovered. She says sometimes it feels like a battle.
The uprising of white men on Beacon Hill is changing. White men and their families is changing the dynamic of the hill. I think that it's great for Seattle to have growth in that way. I'm not sure how I feel about how they are kind of taking over.
Sebelbia ended up buying a place just outside Seattle's city limits. Amazon's trying to change things. It's invested $60 million in programs nationally to develop diverse coding talent. And inside the company, small groups work to represent minority interests.
Well, BEN stands for the Black Employee Network here at Amazon, and what they are is an affinity group.
That's Mark Hatcher. He says his group includes Black employees and their allies. It focuses on
the recruitment and retention of, you know, qualified African-American candidates.
Amazon has many groups like this, like Glamazon, a group for LGBT employees. And a new program that takes Amazon's most diverse employees, that's people who've worked at fulfillment centers, and pays their college tuition. It's served 10,000 people so far. Critics say Amazon hasn't done nearly enough.
You know, I think that's kind of an absurd criticism.
Michael Schutzler is with the Washington Technology Industry Association. It's a trade group financed by companies, including Amazon. Schutzler acknowledges the tech industry has a diversity problem. But he says it's not fair to expect Amazon to fix everything.
This company is just now kind of getting its feet under it.
Schutzler says the company isn't even reliably profitable yet. He says Amazon needs time to address its diversity issues.
At least they're making progress.
He says the real reason Amazon is so white is that Washington State's tech pipeline is white.
Right. The reason ours looks the way it does is because the state has been defunding higher education for 25 straight years.
Now Amazon's looking to bring 50,000 employees to its second headquarters. Schutzler says cities that want to retain their diversity, even if they win that prize, need to take a good look at their state education system, because Amazon can't fix that. I'm Joshua McNichols in Seattle.
This evening's forecast, cloudy skies, low 56 degrees, overcast tomorrow, high 68. You're listening to Newsworks tonight on WHYY. Thanks for being a YStream supporter of WHYY. I'm Dave Heller. Let's pause now for some music. The On Trio are three Korean-American sisters, violinist Angela, pianist Lucia, and cellist Maria. We'll hear their take on the Rodgers and Hart classic, My Funny Valentine.
Thank you.
That's The On Trio, with a deconstructionist rendering of My Funny Valentine by Richard Rodgers and Johnny Hart. It's from their album, Lullaby for My Favorite Insomniac. You're listening to Newsworks Tonight on Pledge Free Y-Stream.
Mount Cuba Center supports WHYY and invites listeners to enjoy an evening hayride through Mount Cuba Center's pristine natural lands, followed by a bonfire and refreshments. Hay Bales and Brews takes place this Saturday, October 14th from 5 to 7 p.m. for those age 21 or older. Mount Cuba Center is a botanical garden located in Hockessin, Delaware, that promotes the conservation of native plants. More on events, course offerings, and visiting hours at mountcubacenter.org.
WHYY is supported by Glenn Mead, an independent trust company founded by the Pugh family to manage their charitable assets. More from Laura LaRosa at 215-419-6027.
Credit Karma supports WHYY, offering credit monitoring and the Credit Karma app.
Welcome back to Newsworks Tonight. I'm Dave Heller. Fairmount, Wissahickon, and Cobbs Creek are among Philadelphia's famed parks that offer residents and tourists endless opportunities to enjoy all that Mother Nature has to offer. The ever-evolving Philadelphia flora and fauna will be taken up by speakers and attendees at the Morris Arboretum's Tree Canopy Conference, Green Infrastructure in the Urbanized Environment. Among the presenters at Haverford College Friday will be Dr. Leslie Brand, climate change specialist with the U.S. Forest Service and Northern Institute of Applied Climate Science. Leslie, thanks for joining us on Newsworks Tonight.
Thank you.
And the topic you'll be presenting is entitled A Framework for Adapting Urban Forests to Climate Change. How do you assess climate change to know how to adapt?
We start with trying to understand what the local impacts of climate change are. So we look at historical records to understand how climate has changed in the past, and then we use models to understand how climate might change at a particular location into the future. We also look at things like changes in hardiness zones based on the coldest days of the year and are used for determining what could be planted where. We also look at changes in things like heat zones, which are determined by the number of days over 86 degrees Fahrenheit. By combining all of that information along with characteristics of specific trees, we can get a better understanding of which trees might be more adaptable to future changes and which trees might be more vulnerable.
What are some of the mainstay tree varieties in the Philadelphia region that form the bulk of our flora?
Some of the trees that are very commonly planted or commonly occurring in Philadelphia are things like black cherry, red maple, ash, northern white cedar, box elder, many, many different species, and they range in their vulnerability. So one of the trees that's most common in the Philadelphia region is black cherry, and that is one that is considered to be highly vulnerable, both because changes in climate are going to reduce habitat suitability for that species, and also because there are things that it's vulnerable to pests and diseases, and it's not as adaptable to a wide variety of conditions.
Can climate change increase vulnerability to specific blights or infestations?
Yeah, with warming temperatures, you can get some insects that are able to invade new areas where they hadn't before. So, for example, southern pine beetle was normally considered a southern pest of pine trees, but more recently it's moved northward along the mid-Atlantic and they found it as far north as Connecticut. They think that there's a relationship between milder winters and the ability for southern pine beetle to move farther north.
Is the intent to safeguard trees, species that are considered vulnerable, and or to increase biodiversity by planting other species of trees?
It can include both things. So when we think about adapting to climate change, we think of it as a range of sort of trying to safeguard things and keep things the way they are, or we can think about transitioning to future conditions. It's up to an individual manager to decide how they're going to manage, whether they're going to manage for persistence and keep things that are of value to them there as long as they can, or manage for change. And then there's many cases where it might be somewhere in the middle. If there is a particular tree that you're very fond of that is particularly vulnerable, you might do things to try to protect it. But there might be other cases where you want to transition into something new. So you might plant trees that are from just slightly south of the area. Or like you said, you could also enhance biodiversity by increasing the number of species that are being planted.
Dr. Brand, thank you so much for helping to paint the picture.
Thank you.
Dr. Leslie Brand is climate change specialist with the U.S. Forest Service and Northern Institute of Applied Climate Science. That's all for tonight's show. NewsWorks Tonight is produced by Shai Ben-Yaakov, Kimberly Haas, and Brett Rader. Thanks for listening. I'm Dave Heller, NewsWorks Tonight.